Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic.
Carl.
And I'm only putting my phone out here not to text or anything during the meeting, just so I can keep track of time so I don't keep you here till breakfast. Anyway, I know. Thank you. Might even catch the last part of the game if I get done soon. I want to thank Lee for asking me to come out here. Lee and I are old friends, and we travel together quite a bit, and he's just getting back at me by having me talk up here in Santa Maria on playoff weekend, for God's sake. Because I swear there was a sign back in Santa Barbara. I'm from Covina, right? 4 hours away. There was a sign in Santa Barbara that said, "You have now reached any lengths, and you have about an hour left to go." That's what it said. And it's always good to see my old friend Archie. We're just talking. We've known each other for 26 years. 26 years, for God's sake. And that, you know what? We were talking about all the people we know that are dead. And that's a rude awakening when you're sitting in a meeting talking about dead people. And it means you've stayed sober too long. That's what it means. God. Anybody buy a Powerball ticket? Of course you did, didn't you? But you don't normally buy Powerball tickets. Because 10 million is not enough, right? It's got to be like 900 million. Right? 10 million won't change your life. Right? And then if you're like me, I was standing in line to get it, and I'm thinking, I've been sober a long time. Maybe I deserve to win something like this. Anybody else feel that way? You catch yourself also and go, oh, wait a minute. That's like wanting a reward for being given a gift, right?
Yeah.
To be picked, to get the lottery because I've been sober. It's like a little kid at Christmas opening up all the presents and then going, okay, now that I've opened all those, what reward do I get? So anyway, I'm an alcoholic. That is the most important thing I can tell you about myself. My sobriety date is January 21st, 1987. I'm 54 years old, so I've been an Alcoholics Anonymous sober more than half my life. And the fact that I'm an alcoholic is really the most dominating feature of who Carl Morris is. You can't even describe me without adding alcohol, alcoholic. You know, and whether I was drinking or whether I've been sober, it's been the thing that has driven my bus. It's been the thing that has made the decision. It has been the thing that has guided my life. It has been the decision maker, drunk or sober, the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. It's not complicated at all. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a really, well, let's call it a unique relationship with alcohol. And this strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. A very strange thing happens when I drink booze, and I assume it happens to you too, otherwise you probably wouldn't be sitting here. What happens to me, the book calls it an allergic reaction when I drink alcohol. They say that the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink booze is what they refer to as the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It happens with nothing else, just booze. An example of that, they're kind enough to... Did you put this... Lee was kind enough to put this bottle of water up here. And over the next 45 minutes to 8 hours that I'm talking with you, I will probably drink at least half this bottle of water. But I can absolutely promise you that once I finish this bottle of water, there is no chance that I'm going to go get a case of water and lock myself in a motel room. There is no chance that that's going to happen. There is no chance that at 3 a.m. I'm going to be calling up Lee, come on, dude. I need another case. I'll turn the pink slip of my car over. Come on, right? It's not going to happen. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical response that I get, if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, well then, Just Say No would have wiped out alcoholism, right? Early 80s, Nancy Reagan came out and said, Just Say No. Well, I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, ha ha, no. And just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other strange part of my relationship with alcohol, and that happens when I'm not drinking it. Of and by myself, if I don't drink for a day, a week, or a month, I seem to have this mind that will paint a picture that makes it okay to take another drink no matter what the pain, humiliation, and suffering was a day, a week, or a month ago. And it never seems to enter into the equation whether it was my pain and humiliation or your pain and humiliation. I could care less. But sooner or later, my mind is able to rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all costs. So I can't drink successfully because of this bizarre physical reaction that I get, but I cannot not drink successfully because of this strange thing we call the mental obsession. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Because I swear to you, if I could do either one of those two things, I would. If I could drink successfully, I would. If I could on my own not drink successfully, tonight I'd be at home watching the Steeler-Cincinnati game. And when Lee called me, Carl, what are you doing? I'd say, well, I'm watching a football game. He would say, well, how are you staying sober doing stuff like that? I'd go, well, I'm just saying no. Right? But I don't have that ability of him by myself. I can't. I'm going to harp on that physical feature a little bit more because it's the one thing, bar none, we all have in common. Because our backgrounds, if you're new or fairly new and somebody has said, just sit here until you hear your story, you might be sitting here for a long time if you're listening for the wrong things. Because our stories are very, very different because Alcoholics Anonymous is a huge, wide cross-section of society. Every single race, creed, color, religion, custom, background, good family, bad family, education, no education, we're all here. In fact, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only place where the bank president, the bank teller, and the bank robber are all right here in the same room, right? And they all have a very different story about what just happened, right? But on top of the fact that we come from different places, we also drink differently. We really do. If you listen closely in meetings, you will find out we drink differently than each other. To illustrate that, let's imagine this. We crack open the back door. We wheel in a giant cart full of all the kinds of booze we all love. Right? If you're a top shelf expensive drinker, we got it for you. Remy Martin, Cavassier, we got it. If you're a bottom shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020. We got it all. And everything in between, a bunch of you just started to salivate on that Mad Dog, didn't you? Oh, yeah, it gets you there. Right? And everything in between. We wheeled that right in the middle of the room and we all took a good four or five stiff drinks. Real drinks. No umbrellas in there, no mixer, just good four or five stiff drinks. We'd all be acting very, very differently. Right? Over in this corner we'd have the good time crowd. Ah ha ha ha, talk, 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 fun, fun, woo! Right? Having a good time in that crowd. Over in that corner, we'd have the sobbers. You know, they're woo, right? They get too drunk and all they do is cry. Ah! Over in this corner, we'd have the fighters, right? You know them, right? Four drinks in, they got to fight. Over in this corner, a bunch of us would be naked. Right? I personally would be visiting each corner trying to find a couple of friends to come over here with me. So our stories are different based upon which corner we're in, right? Over in this corner, in the good time crowd, they get a lot of DUIs, right? Hey, next bar, hey, this bar sucks. Three more drinks, we're going over to the next bar. You know, 2 a.m., holy smokes, we got to stop at the bar. We've got to stop at the store, go to Fred's after hours. Always out there on the road, get a lot of DUIs in that corner. The sobbing corner, they don't get any DUIs. They don't even leave the house. Just, whoa, right? The worst thing they do is the late night drunk slobber dialing. Right? Calling different countries at midnight. Or, God forbid, these days, drunk Facebooking. That's the worst thing. Right? It's the worst they do. They don't get in any trouble. Over in this corner, the fighting corner, always got probation, parole, attorneys, court dates in their story. Over in this corner, bunch of children show up by surprise. Oh, man. So our stories are different based upon what corner we're in. But there's one thing, no matter which corner we're in, there's one thing we would all be doing. We would all be back at that cart for another drink. Right? And it was so important when I was new for me to listen to that, to what happens to you when you drink and what happens to you when you, on your own, try not to drink. Because if I'm listening for that, I'm you, you're me. I don't care what kind of family you came from. I don't care where you came from. I don't care what kind of background, what kind of race, creed, color, religion you are. If I'm listening to what happens to you when you drink and what happens to you on your own when you try not to drink, I'm you, you're me. It could, you know, doesn't matter who you are. I can identify with that. So I set this relationship up with alcohol that I just described to you right from the get-go. When I first started drinking much later than most people in AA. I was 11. That is kind of late these days. We lived in Seattle. A typical morning for me in seventh grade would be I'd show up early for school, not for study hall or anything, but to meet my new friends at the very edge of the school property, Loser's Corner. Every school's got a Loser's Corner. It's 10 feet off the school property. It's kind of like the way AA meetings treat the smokers these days, right? In fact, they don't even let you smoke at this one, right? You got to go, what, down to 7-Eleven, half mile away? But, you know, every school, 10 feet off the school property, all those kids would be out there smoking cigarettes, trying to look cool before school. And then we would also have what I like to call the playground cocktail. That is a jar full of whatever we could rip off out of the parents' liquor cabinet the night before. And that jar is pretty scary because none of us have been to bartending school yet. So, and plus, you're in a hurry when you're ripping off the parents, you know. You're not measuring things. You're just, right? So there's equal amounts of whiskey, vodka, cream de menthe, vermouth all in this jar. And you can imagine 7 or 8 of us, 11, 12-year-olds, handing that around at 7 a.m., choking that down. Of course, it was the early 70s, so we're smoking that commercial pot. Anybody remember that stuff? Four-finger lids, $10 a bag, seeds and stems and the whole bit. And it was even before Ziploc baggies were invented, when it would just be a regular Glad bag. And as you'd roll it up, there'd be like 9 people spit on it. Go, oh, man. Back all those seeds and stems and leaves into a homemade pipe, maybe made out of plumbing fittings and a screen. Or if you're really desperate that morning, would be a toilet paper roll with aluminum foil and pinholes in it. Are you guys there? Yeah, that's why you're here. So by the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, and I'm the neighborhood drunk, I'm the neighborhood pot dealer, I forgot to mention, but my father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. He didn't find anything funny about this at all. My parents, really good people, and they saw something was happening to me. It was obvious, but they didn't understand. It was obvious that something was going on. By the time I'm 14, my hair is down onto my shoulders and in front of my bloodshot eyes, and my vocabulary is, whoa. Whoa, right? That's my vocabulary. So my parents are like, ah! But they didn't understand I was alcoholic. They blamed my problems on people, place, and things. They thought if we can get him away from that damn group of kids he's hanging out with, things would get better. If we can get him out of that damn public school system, things would get better. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental relationship to alcohol. You see, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is that I'm loaded with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. So by the time I was about 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle. After getting kicked out of the private school system, my parents decided that Seattle was a problem. If we can get them out of Seattle, things would get better. So they sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. And I spent 3 years at Washington State University on my parents' money, and in that 3 years, I got almost 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, about a 0.25. That's not 2.5, that'd be a C average. I'd be boasting about that. I'm talking 0.25. By the time I was 22, this little story I'm about to tell you will let you know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, my father was Swedish, my mother is Icelandic, therefore I look like a polar bear. And I don't know whether this custom I'm about to tell you about is Scandinavian or whether it's Lutheran. I don't know. But at Christmas time, my parents wouldn't just send out Christmas cards to their friends and relatives. My parents would send out this big, long Christmas letter that said everything the family had been doing that year. And when I was about 22, I got a hold of one of these letters that had been sent out the previous Christmas. And as I read it, it let me know exactly where I stood with my family. Now, the first paragraph talked about what my parents had been doing that year. Another impressive year, I'm sure. The next paragraph talked about what the Morris children had been doing that year, and that paragraph went something like this. Our oldest daughter, Christina, just graduated from Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, with a master's degree in human resources. She's now working for a large pharmaceutical company in the Midwest. She traveled to Europe this summer. She saw this, she saw that. Her hobbies are this, this, and this. She's a very happy young woman. We are very proud of her. Our oldest son, Eric, just graduated from Western Washington State University with a degree in marketing. He's now working for a large advertising firm here in downtown Seattle. He loves to golf. He loves to travel. He's engaged to be married to this wonderful woman named Mary Lou, who works for a very small company here in Seattle named Microsoft. It was small at one time. And they love to golf together. They love to travel together. He's a very happy young man. We are very proud of him. Our youngest son, Carl, just turned 22. They were actually being kind about this. It's about this same time. It really, what I'm about to say is really encompassing about a 7 to 9 month period, but it really would take to a breakfast to describe all of the things involved and the nuances and all of that. And so I just say this one sentence to cover it all. A really bad night happened, so I joined the Navy. It was that bad of a night. On my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test. It's called the ASVAB test. And this test that I took qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you, that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that would even maybe possibly or even remotely allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base for boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. I should have been kicked out, series of events I was kept in anyway, but they took away that nuclear status thing. Thank God for you guys. A year and a half later, I'm a lower rank than when I first came in. It's kind of like this. I knew I was in the Navy. It was obvious. I mean, you can't argue with facts. I'd be standing on the deck of a big gray ship. I would look at my surroundings. By God, I'm in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I'm on a big gray ship. Well, I'm in a uniform, no doubt about it. I am in the United States Navy. However, that ship would pull into a port. I would leave that ship and I'd take a drink, and I would totally forget that I'm in the Navy. And there's something else that's happening to me at this point in my life. At this point, I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old. And now, at this point in my life, when I take a drink, I don't know whether it's going to be 3 hours or 3 days that I'm going to come out of this drunk. I'm literally, at 23 and 24 years old, finding myself going into these three-day drunks that are, like, baffling me. And it's a strange feeling. It's a very strange feeling coming out of one of those three-day drunks in a foreign country. On a large pier at 6 a.m. going, there was a destroyer here the other day. Right? The Navy really frowns on that behavior. Our ship was back in port. I was coming out of one of those, another three-day drunk. It was early Monday morning. I was late getting back to the ship. And what I would always do at this point, I would always try to save a pint knowing coming out of that three-day drunk and having to get back to my ship, I would try to get half a pint in me before I had to get back to that ship. So that's what I was doing. I'm driving back into the ship, and I'm trying to get that half a pint in me. And I guess I was paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me than where the car was going. And at the front of every Navy base, there is a guard shack where a Marine stands duty. And under normal circumstances, you're supposed to slowly and politely pull your car up to the guard shack. You're supposed to show him your military ID. He'll check the sticker on your car. If everything is in order, he'll allow you to proceed onto the base. As I said, this particular morning, I'm paying more attention to getting that half a pint in me. And I remember bringing it down. My eyes come into focus. And I saw the Marine had his head out of the guard shack. Like, I was wondering what you're so excited about. And I was kind of shocked and looked down. I'm still going 40 miles an hour. I tried to yank the wheel to swerve. There was a big cement median on the right-hand side. The car hit that, flipped over, and bang, right through that guard shack. I can still see that Marine doing this big dive out of there. Did a quick flip, weapon drawn, right back up. Thank God those guys are in good shape. The Navy was very angry at me that morning. The Marine was all right. They're patching me up at the hospital for minor injuries, and they're reading new charges on me. And this is nothing significant, new charges. That's just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. So there's nothing significant about new charges. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called Anabuse for me. And I was now under orders to show up at sick bay every morning before quarters, and the corpsman would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure it actually got in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism, and that is I had no booze in my system, and I was literally going insane. See, throughout my life, for a number of years now, people that either loved me or had some sort of authority over me had been intermittently taking alcohol away from me. They always seemed to think that was the problem. And indeed, I'm sure it looked like it was the problem. But they always defined my alcoholism by flunking out of school, the wrecked cars, winding up in the hospital, all of these repercussions of too much drinking. And they'd always point at that. But I've been strangely suspicious of something else for many years by this time. That really, if I could have had the vocabulary to yell back, because normally these people would be yelling at me. If I could yell back, and if I had the vocabulary, I could have said, yes, I agree. I see that the price is getting very high for my drinking. I'm on your side. I'm not happy that the car is on fire either. You know, I didn't want that to happen. I can see why you're upset. But if you knew how I felt when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. And I did not have the vocabulary nor any type of self-knowledge to know that in that feeling that I was so wanting to spit back out, I was defining alcoholism. That there's only one thing worse than the price I'm paying for the drinking, and that's the way I feel when I'm not drinking. And the book calls that the jumping off place. No matter which way I turn, I lose. And I remember counting those days on that anabuse, just... in 4 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 6 days, and I'm on antabuse. Now it's been 8 days, 6 hours, and 15 minutes, and I'm on antabuse. I started to look around that ship. The other men. They're talking behind my back. All 300 of them. Have you ever felt that way in AA? The only difference is that in AA, we are talking behind your back. It's not an illusion. It's actually happening. I'm sure only with love and tolerance up here in the Central Coast, though. On the 10th day, I went AWOL from my ship, and I locked myself in a little hotel room in downtown San Diego, Plaza Hotel. It's on 4th and Broadway. It's still there. This would have been mid-1986. The Plaza Hotel was $13 a night back then. I checked about a year ago. Just went on a little nostalgic sort of tour. And Plaza Hotel is still there. They've remodeled that whole gas lamp area of San Diego. Plaza Hotel is right there. It's now $19 a night. It's one of those types of places. And I remember sitting on the edge of the bed in the Plaza Hotel, and I had on this rickety little end table, I had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass. And as I stared at the bottle of vodka, I was thinking, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of antabuse when they prescribed it for me. They had said, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this antabuse, you will get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction is you might die. I remember looking at the bottle and I thought, well, wonder which reaction I'm going to get. And I took one shot. And nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure. And I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face. So I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat. Then all of a sudden, I was like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. You guys are sick if you think this is funny. I actually have proof. You guys all look very, very normal, you know, most of you. There's a few that are suspect, but for the most part, you look pretty normal. But apparently you're not well if you think this story is sick. And I have proof of that. I'm going to skip ahead a couple of years. I'm coming back to this hotel room because important stuff happened in there. But I skip ahead a couple of years. I'm 2 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That was the result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and apparently merciful God and a personnelman that lost half my file. That's how that happened. But my first sponsor was a guy on my ship, and his sponsor, who was a guy who's about my age right now with my amount of time. I remember he was in his mid-50s with, you know, mid-20s sobriety. I remember thinking, God, he's old. He's been here forever. And but he was a real stickler about that ninth step, just always hounding me through my sponsor, right? Because my sponsor was even younger than me, right? The other guy on my ship was 14 months ahead of me and 2 years younger than me. So anyway, really hounding me about that ninth step. They took my whole Navy paycheck for my first 2 years just to pay me, try to get me even with the world before I would come back out to the world. I mean, they did some great stuff that I hated back then. But one of the things that amends I was unable to make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree. Remember that? Right? They had paid for one. I didn't have one. There's a little discrepancy there if you really look at the steps. That I needed to do one of two things with my parents. Either pay them back every single nickel that they had wasted on that, or I had to go get what they paid for in the first place. So I used some military benefits when I got out, and that's how I moved to Covina. That's right when I met Archie. I mean, literally, right when I moved to Covina, Archie was right there in the noon meetings. And so I signed up to go to school for this bachelor's program in telecommunications management. And one of the classes I had to take was this business presentation class. It's like a speech class for, you guessed it, giving business presentations. And in the first couple of semesters of this speech class, the instructor was randomly pointing at students one at a time, putting them up in front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor would shout out a topic, and each student was supposed to, off the cuff, just talk for 90 seconds, maybe 3 minutes, about whatever the instructor had said. So after about 8 or 9 students had been thrown up there, he pointed at me, and I walk up to the front of the room, and from the back of the room, the instructor shouts out, "Talk about a bizarre situation in your life." So I told them about drinking on top of Anabuse. They didn't respond like you guys. They were like, there were a couple of guys in there going, "Woohoo, right on, dude, party!" Right? So I'm back in the hotel room. I'm red-faced, I'm hyperventilating, and I'm sweating. And I take another shot, and up it came. My second sponsor was a man named Eddie Cochran, and of course, Archie remembers him. He passed away in 1999 with 47 years of sobriety. This December, had he lived, he would be taking his 65-year cake. One of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. I swear, if you kind of study the history of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous, you would find that Eddie Cochran had a huge influence on Southern California AA. Anyway, he called the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I'm unfamiliar with. Because we all know normal puking, right? You're just out there in the middle of a good drunk and you get that little warning, right? Little sour taste in the back of your throat. Maybe a little bit comes up in your mouth and you go, mm. And we all know when we get that warning, we have 30 to 60 seconds to find a bathroom if there happens to be one. If we're driving, we really try to get the window down because it's a real buzzkill for the rest of the night if you puke all over your dashboard. Plus, when it gets into the air vents, it's now we've got weeks where it's a real bummer. Plus, it's a total blow-it giveaway if you get pulled over and you got puke all over the car. Really, I mean, they just don't even give you the breathalyzer. They just, come on, right? But we get the warning, right? But here on the Anabuse, no warning. Just, sort of this Linda Blair spray across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room as the bed. It's a design feature, I believe, maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of Anabuse, that if you hang in there and you keep drinking and keep puking and you keep drinking and keep... See, if you're going to be successful at drinking on Anabuse, you got to get two things going on at the very same time. Right? First thing is, you got to hang in there. You cannot half-measure drinking on top of Anabuse. You really need to hang in there. And at the very same time, don't die. If you can put those two things together, have at it. With me, if I kept drinking and kept puking and kept drinking and kept puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the Anabuse would kick out of my system and I'd quit throwing up and I would just be left with red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm all right with that. Right? So I drank on top of Anabese the last 7 months of my drinking. My second and my last drunk, I was left for dead in a motel parking lot in an area of San Diego called National City. I came to on an operating table. You know when you come out of those blackouts and you look around your surroundings for, you know, how much trouble am I in? Am I in my own bed? Or, you know, an operating table is evidence of a bad night. It really is. It's one of those things you go, oh, this is bad. Right? Also, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a little bit offended by something. A lot of people said, oh, I'm just so glad to be sober. I now wake up. I don't come out of blackouts anymore and then look across the bed and, be scared by what I'm looking at. I know what, you know, they were indicating that they would wake up and they'd be frightened by the person next to them. See, that why that offended me is because I used to come out of blackouts and I'd look across and I'd go, wow, not bad. They would wake up, look at me and go, oh, God, and run out. You see, there's always two sides of that story, and apparently you guys all claim to be on the good side, like you're all good looking or something. Jesus. My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail. I'm being transferred from civilian authorities back to military authorities. Everybody's angry. Everybody's in uniforms. I'm in handcuffs, right? You know those mornings, right? People in uniforms that are angry and you're in handcuffs. It's also one of those mornings where my neck muscles weren't working well. And that morning, the officer deck on my ship just put his arm up when we tried to approach the ship with shore patrol. He said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or treatment. Now, as I stood there in that morning in handcuffs and angry people in uniform around me, apparently some sort of option was thrown out on the table. Now, I don't remember as I stood there in handcuffs thinking, oh, God, you're so good to a bum like me. I don't know which way to turn and look at you. Give me some sort of option. I don't remember that. Nor do I remember thinking, and it would have been more likely, but I don't remember this either. It would have been more likely that I would have thought, hey, if I just act like I want that treatment thing, maybe I can beat this one too. That's more likely, but I don't remember that. I now know that it would not have mattered what I was thinking or feeling that morning because I was in handcuffs. And I don't know about your experience in handcuffs, but my experience throughout my life was always the same. Whoever had me in handcuffs, never once did they ever turn to me and say, so what's your opinion on this matter? Right? When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And they took me up to this military treatment center in the north end of San Diego, and when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off me. And that is what the society in which I live, and apparently I'm supposed to be serving, that's how they felt about how Carl Morris acts out there in the world without Alcoholics Anonymous. They're willing to take the handcuffs off me when the doors are locked behind me. So I'm in this treatment center, and I'm being told I'm going to be there for 45 days, and 35 other men and women from various ships, bases, and commands start showing up. And in the first few days, they're doing medical checkups on us. You know, they're calling us in for these interviews to find out what ship, base, or command we came from so we can get our files sent over so they kind of know who we are. And they're doing group therapy. They've got us in this big group therapy session. And I think this guy was new at his job, and he's trying to talk to us and trying to get us to talk. We're not talking at all, but he's giving us his best. He's got the whiteboard up there and drawing the progression of alcoholism, the charts, and he's, you know, giving us his best. But none of us are talking. We're all arms folded, looking down at the ground. He's getting more frustrated as the hours go by that nobody wants to talk. Somewhere late in the third day, I think it was, this one fellow raised his hand. His name was Paco. He's from some other base somewhere, some other ship, I don't remember. But he goes, I'd like to say something. And the facilitator says, yes, Paco, what would you like to say? And Paco said, I hear that I'm supposed to be rigorously honest with you guys if I'm going to do this staying sober thing. And I want you guys to know that Paco's not my real name. Paco's just a name I've always used whenever things look like trouble. And the other day when I got here, this really looked like trouble. But I want to be honest and upfront with you guys and let you guys know that my real name is Randy. Will you guys call me Randy from now on? And we all kind of go, okay, nice to meet you, Randy. We didn't care one way or the other, but this facilitator got really excited. Said, oh my God, there's a first breakthrough of any honesty of any of you SOBs. Later that afternoon, they called us all back into that room, and they called Randy up from the back of the room, and he walked all the way to the front. They had engraved a gold name tag with Randy, and slapped it on his chest, and then informed the rest of us that whenever staff was not around, Randy's in charge. Randy's like, I guess he'd get promoted pretty quickly in this treatment thing. I don't know. So Randy loved his new job, and we hated Randy. On the seventh day in this place, they took us all to our first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. At least it was my first meeting. I'd never been to a meeting. I don't remember giving it any thought prior to my life. I had heard of it. Of course, you can't be out there drinking and getting in trouble without hearing of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I had never come across you guys before. I probably had come across individually people who may have tried to talk to me, but I wasn't aware of it. So, all I knew is we'd been in this place 7 days, and over the 1MC, it's like an intercom system through the barracks. They said, civilian clothes, parking lot, 6 p.m., so we're all out there, and five white vans pull up, and a guy with a clipboard started barking as to which van we're supposed to get in, so six or seven guys were in each van, and boom, each van took off to a different meeting somewhere in San Diego County. And the van I was in pulled up at one of your meetings. We sat all in a row in the back row. I still see it when I go down to San Diego. The military sits right along the back row. And you guys just carried on. Just carry on with your meeting. I knew that you were not putting on a show for us. You were doing what you normally do, and you were just happy to have us there. You didn't care whether we truly met the condition of truly believing we were alcoholic. You just sort of like, let us be there. And I remember sitting back there, and it was a podium. A lot of San Diego meetings are podium participation, right? They don't let you sit in your chair. They have a podium up here, and somebody leaves the meeting, points at people, go to the front. So a long string of people came up to a podium up here. First few read, like you guys did tonight, and then the remaining 10 or 12 people that got up there each talked for 3 to 5 minutes. And each one got up there, I got more amazed as the time went by. I guess these people took being at the podium seriously, because what happened to me that night, I truly believe, is what Alcoholics Anonymous wants to have happen to a new person. I was identifying. I got this overwhelming feeling as each person talked, and while I listened to the reading, I got this overwhelming feeling of, oh my God, they know. They know. Jesus, they know. Now, if you would have seen me back there going, oh, and you go, hey, kid, what is it that they know that you think you know? I would have gone, I don't know, but they know. And I was identifying, and I was identifying with two things. I was identifying with the way you described your drinking, and I identified with the way you described the way you felt when you were not drinking. Each of you seemed to have these quick little stories you could tell that let me know that you were the type that sold your soul for a drink. And then you also had these little stories that just very quickly you could let me know that you had no ability to not take the next drink. I'll never forget, in that same meeting, I heard somebody describe the alcoholic mind better than I've heard in the almost 29 years that I've been here. I know I'm fronting myself about 11 days here, sorry. I've never heard the alcoholic mind described better than this. This one guy got called on, he walked all the way to the front, he said, my name's Jack, I'm an alcoholic. My mind would have killed my body a long time ago, except it needed it for transportation. And he sat down and said, whoa. The next night, they took us to another meeting. And as much as I identified in the first meeting, I got equally confused at this next meeting, because everybody at this meeting was talking about something called a drug of choice. People up there said, well, my drug of choice is. And somebody goes, well, my drug of choice. And I'm sitting in the back going, was I supposed to be choosing out there? What the hell are they talking about? Do they want me to choose now? What are they talking about? Next morning, I'm back at the treatment center. I asked the counselor who'd been assigned to us, I go, Mary, question, I got a question. Last night in the meeting, they're talking about something called a drug of choice. What on earth do they mean by that? And she said, Carl, let's play a game. Now that kind of startled me, kind of worried me, because I knew what she was saying. She was saying, pay attention. And that was hard to pay attention. I didn't know it at the time. And maybe if you've been to treatment, they did this to you too. When they did the medical checkup on me, they found that I had, my liver was what they called extended. I'm 25 years old, but they said I had a liver of a 70-year-old man. My pancreas was shutting down, and I had extreme what they call alcoholic edema, where you can put your fingers on your skin, and the fingerprints will stay there, and you can smell alcohol. Apparently, drinking on top of antabuse for 7 months does a little number on your internal organs. Who knew? And when they find you in that medical condition, they're worried about you throwing a seizure, right? Because if you throw a seizure, it kind of interrupts the day. it scares the other patients, and you know, the sirens have to go off. And so that what they do to avoid that is they give you this little cup of pills, right, that stops you from throwing a seizure. If you've ever been on that cup of pills, you know what I'm talking about. Your field of vision about the width of this aisle here is just fine. But there's dancing squiggly things over here. And when you turn to see what it is, now it's over here, right? And so you're doing a lot of this. So if you're ever at your meeting and the white van pulls up and, you know, six or seven people get out and they still got the bracelet on and they're doing a little of this, that's what's going on. They're on the cup of pills. So when she said, "Carl, we'll figure out what your drug of choice is. Let's play a game." I went, "Okay." And she said, "Imagine this, Carl. Imagine I walked in this room," she said. "Imagine I walked in this room and I had a tray. And on that tray, I had a bottle of Jack Daniels, an ounce of cocaine, and an ounce of Thai sticks. Which one would you take?" I started to drool immediately. Right out the side of my mouth. "Did I take them all?" And she started to snap her fingers. "Settle down, Carl. Settle down. You can't have them all. You can only have one. Play the game, Carl." I'm like, "All right." She said, "You can only have one. Which one would you take?" And I thought, well, I guess if I can only have one, Mary, I guess I'd take the ounce of cocaine. She said, "Maybe cocaine is your drug of choice. Do you understand now?" And I go, "No." She said, "What's the problem?" I said, "Well, Mary, the only reason I take the ounce of cocaine over the other two is, well, I take that ounce of cocaine, I get the hell out of here, and I sell 2 8-balls. I would now have enough money for a quarter pound of Thai sticks and a case of Jack Daniels. Now, the only reason I bring that up is to bring up a very important aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new or fairly new, you need to hear this. There's only one sobriety date. No matter what I may think my drug of choice is right now, if I'm new and I'm going through that, am I mostly addict, a little bit alcoholic, mostly alcoholic, maybe, doesn't matter. There's only one sobriety date. I bet you there's a lot of people in here that work with new people. Maybe you run across this scenario like I do every once in a while. Not often, but every once in a while. "Hey, good to see you, buddy. How long do you got?" Every once in a while, my home group in Covina, I get this. Not often, but once in a while. "Well, my drinking sobriety date is January 4th. My pot clean date is May 3rd. Oh, I blew my methamphetamine date last night. I was in Walmart all night long." Like, no. One sobriety date. Funniest thing I ever heard about sobriety day, same scenario. Saw a guy around my home group for a while. "Hey, good to see you. How long do you got?" And he said, "Well, I had 90 days, but I drank last night, so now I have 89 days. I know, it took me a second, too. Like, I almost had to call my sponsor and check on that. I think that's kind of similar to being down in Mexico and looking at the tequila going, "Would that affect my U.S. sobriety date?" Yes. Yes, sobriety dates are international. Just a little information for the new person, that's all. So after 45 days, they're going to let us all out, just what the orders were. And they're going to let us out on a Friday. And on the Wednesday before that Friday, they gather all 35 of us up and put us in this room. And the door opened, and the biggest, meanest counselor in the place walks through that door. And that, he's a Marine. That day, he's in his full dress uniform. And I got to tell you, a Marine in his full dress uniform is a very impressive, very intimidating sight. And when we saw he was in his full dress uniform, we were chit-chatting. We just went dead silent. And he walked across that floor up to a podium in front, and he stood there, didn't say a word, and just stared at us. Panned the room. Felt like forever. It was probably 30 seconds. Then he finally spoke, and he said, "You 35 have been through one of the finest treatment centers in the world for alcoholism and drug addiction. This treatment center has been here for many, many years. And over the years, the statistics have shown us that out of you 35, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward. Many of you will die, go insane, wind up in prison." Nice little exit pep talk, don't you think? Then he said, "Many of you relapse once, twice, maybe 20 times, and then make it back to long-term sobriety. But according to this treatment center statistics, only one of you will stay continuously sober from this day forward." Man, if you thought it was quiet before he said talk, you could hear a pin drop in the room now. The only thing you could hear was me going, "Shit." Because I knew if only one of us was going to make it, it was not going to be me. We all knew who it was going to be. It's going to be Randy over here. There he is. He's like the poster boy of the treatment center by now. Turned in term papers on acceptance and stuff. So on this Friday afternoon, they're letting us all out. Everybody's taken back to the ship's base and commands in various different ways. And there were four or five of us that were informed that we had been arrested in vehicles the night before we were thrown into this place. So our vehicles had been in an impound lot for the last 45 days. So we were told, stand on the front doorstep of the treatment center. Your cars will be brought out of that impound lot one at a time, just to sit. So we're standing out there and we're kind of looking at each other. And all of a sudden, this car comes across the parking lot. And one of the guys that I'm standing with goes, is that Randy in that car? We look a little bit closer. Yep, that's Randy. One of the other guys says, he's drinking already. Sure enough, Randy's got a bottle. He's polishing it off. He rolls right in front of us, rolls down the window, goes, ha, 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 throws the bottle right at us, crash. Look up, he gives us a finger, and he drives up. I guess his name was Paco again. I don't know. Next thing that I remember of that day is I showed up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at the Pacific Beach, the North Shore Alano Club in Pacific Beach, the 6 o'clock gong show meeting on Friday night. Truth about my life right there that night. I had 45 days without a drink. I had a lot of information. And I was physically feeling better than I had felt since I'd been a young teenager. But there had been no spiritual awakening, spiritual experience, or even a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism. And what was even more dangerous than the fact that it hadn't happened is that I did not know I needed one. But I did know that the only place where I felt safe was a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did know that, and that was enough. That Friday night, I'm sitting in the back of that meeting, and one guy that night operating on his primary purpose. I'm sure there were a lot of other guys that night operating on their primary purpose, but this guy had decided to start lurking in the back rows. And he came up to me and said, hey, never seen you here before. What are you doing? I didn't think quick enough to lie to him, because I swear to you, if I would have thought for just one more second, I would have lied to him. I accidentally told him the truth. I said, I don't know. I just got out of a Navy treatment center a couple hours ago. I don't know what I'm doing. This guy's eyes went bing, big smile went across his face. At the break of the meeting, he's like fighting his friends off. He's mine! Mine! I got this guy. Mine! Leave him alone! Mine! I didn't know you marked your newcomers, for God's sake. But there was something, other than this guy being a guy that liked to work with new guys, there was something else going on in his life that particular Friday night that made him especially glad to meet me. This guy's girlfriend had left him the night before for one of his friends in his home group. Exactly. So he was wondering what he was going to do with his weekend, homicide, suicide, get loaded, or grab this newcomer. He's like all over me all weekend. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy was insane over this woman, flat out insane. In between this barrage of meetings he took me to, he'd throw me in the passenger side of his car. He'd start driving and he'd start yelling. He wouldn't even look at the road. He had like one of those AA radar cars that just made it to the next meeting. And he'd be yelling at me, you gotta go to meetings, you gotta read the book, you gotta get a sponsor. Damn her! Gotta go to meetings, gotta read the book, damn her! And like, he was like spitting on me. Like, right. Now, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy, that night in his pain, was a guy in Alcoholics Anonymous who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore he understood that the solution to his pain was out of self, out of self, out of self. I am so glad that that guy, that night, was not at home underneath his covers, whining into his sponsor's answer machine. If you're 25 years old or younger, an answer machine is this little box that used to sit on the kitchen counter. So glad that he was not at home underneath his covers, whining into his sponsor's answer machine. Sponsor, where are you? Fix me. Give me a golden answer. I'm so glad that his sponsor had probably taught him, yes, yes, I will give you some answers to your current problem. But if you learn to work with others, you will have a lifetime of solutions at your fingertips. And I'm so glad he had been taught that. By going to so many meetings in the same area of town with that guy over that weekend, I learned something really valuable about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new. By going to so many meetings in the same area of town over a weekend, I saw other people that were at multiple meetings over that weekend. Now, I didn't see anybody else doing 18 meetings, just me and that guy. But I saw other people that were at two or three meetings over that weekend. And what I learned about how we go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, especially when we're new, I'm going to correlate it to a football game. Now, a football team is out there on the field for one reason and one reason only, to win the game. And how do they win that game? They huddle up, they make a plan, and they do one play. Then they huddle up again, they make another plan, and they do one play. That's exactly what we do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The game around here is one day without a drink, you're a big winner. And how do we do that one day? We run in here and we huddle up. But remember, we're bodily and mentally different from our fellows. Break! We go out there and we try a little of this, we try a little of that, and we run right back in here. Just a little. Lee is recording the Cincinnati-Pittsburgh game. Don't tell him what's going on. After that weekend, I got back to my ship, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. I told you about him earlier. He was 23 years old. I was 25, but he had 14 months at that time. He became my first sponsor even before I asked him. Just one of those guys. He didn't care. He understood. He needed me. He was all over me. Now I didn't know that. I was just wondering, why is this guy all over me? It's like he had a captive audience. I was going to have to jump overboard to get away from him. But he understood because he had a sponsor that I was like gold being delivered to him on a silver platter, right? That he could work with me. And he just started to do those things. He would be down at my workstation. Hey, how you doing today? What meeting are you going to tonight? Well, I'm going to this one. You're coming with me. Like, all right. My first 6 months of sobriety was meeting, coffee, 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 meeting, coffee, 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 see a girl, ah, meeting, coffee, 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 meeting. And I ran around meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous desperately hoping you would say something funny, clever, or insightful, because if you did, then I'd get this feeling of, okay, I'm all right. 10 minutes later, no, I'm not all right. Meeting, coffee, 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 meeting. I didn't understand that I was running around Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time in the midst of Alcoholics Anonymous with untreated alcoholism. I didn't understand. 6 or 7 months sober, our ship had to go out to sea for an extended period of time, and my first sponsor, Bob, said, meet me in the aft end of the ship in the battery shop in engine room 1 every night at 6:30 p.m. So I showed up that first night, and he shows up, and he's got this blue book with him. You know this book. Tosses it down on the table. He says, I've been hounding about it for months. Have you read it? And I said something like, yeah. There's like how it works. We antagonists, some doctor with some opinion about something. At 6 months of sobriety, it's very possible that I would have mixed up Dr. Bob, Dr. Silkworth, and Dr. Paul. And I bet you anything there's at least two people in the room tonight that don't even understand what I just said. Please, if you've been here any significant amount of time, you've got to understand who the players in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous are, or you can't really understand the immense privilege we have of sitting in these chairs. See, to be around Alcoholics Anonymous for any considerable time and not understand maybe who Dr. Silkworth is or who Ebbie Thatcher is or Roland Hazard, if you don't know who those players are and what part they played, and to be in Alcoholics Anonymous any significant amount of time, that would sort of be like sitting around church for a few years and then one day going, Mary? There's somebody named Mary involved in this? Really? Right? It just wouldn't make much sense. You wouldn't grasp what it's about. So he gave me a real gift when he, down in that little engine room at the bottom of that ship, of the USS Cushing, every night we would start read. He would read, I would read. He would read, I would read. And he started to share with me what little he knew. Remember, he was only 14 months ahead of me. He was no expert. Right? It was like the blind leading the blind. It was Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. He was just trying to stay sober. He probably mixed up all sorts of stuff. You know when you try to impress new people and you try to explain the difference between Roland Hazard and Ebbie Thatcher and who they are? I bet you he mixed them up. Who cares? Step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. It doesn't say perfectly. It doesn't say expertly. He understood that concept. And he was working with me not because I was alcoholic. He was working with me because he was alcoholic. He had no idea whether I would stay sober or not. And the magic happened for both of us. two men in the bottom of that ship, in that engine room, had an experience with the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't all of a sudden just snap to, you know, I remember the very first huge thing that happened to me, you know. I described running around for meetings, you know, having this thing inside me that I couldn't define it. You know, many nights I'd be holding my gut after being to a meeting going, what's wrong with me? If this is sobriety. And after reading the book, I got the immense, immense gift. Although I might have that feeling, I no longer was saying, what's wrong with me? I now knew. The immense gift of going, alcoholism. See, if I can't define it, I can't find a solution. And if I don't really understand the grave nature of alcoholism while not drinking, you know what's going to happen to a guy like me? I'm going to get misdiagnosed all over the place. And if I don't, that's enough of that. As I told you, 2 years sober, got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. I move up to Covina to go to school. I remember puttering on up, like I told you, my first sponsor, his sponsor, real sticklers on that amends. I'm still push starting the same car I got sober with when I'm 2 years sober. And I'd be getting the Navy paycheck now for 2 years. I got this little Volkswagen with a hole in the floorboard. I got to wiggle a screwdriver in the steering column to connect it and push start it. It was a real trick. And I'm puttering on up with everything I own up the LA freeway trying to find this town called Covina. And I'm puttering on and nice cars were going by and they're honking at me. What I kept hearing was, loser! Loser! And I'm like, oh God, I gotta get a life. I really gotta get a life. I'm 2 years sober. I've heard people talk about having a life in AA. I need to get one. I'll find out where the meetings are, but you know, I'm gonna have to work. I'm gonna be going to school. I won't have much time to go to the meetings. I really need to buckle down. I'm behind here. I'm behind. I'm 27 years old and I am behind. And I literally, that's the way I was thinking. I pulled in. The first thing I was disappointed by the meeting hall there in Covina. We call it the 502 Club. We like to call it the sobriety capital of the world. I know you guys probably think you're the sobriety capital of the world, but we think we are. First thing I was disappointed by was that the parking lot's flat. One of the tools for living when you're push starting your car is you don't like flat parking lots, right? You're always looking for a little bit of an incline to park on. But I stayed in there, and then I went into the noon meeting. You probably were even there that first day, but what I remember is when I met Eddie Cochran. He was making coffee that day, and he had this medallion that said 1951. I knew what that meant. That meant he was 10 years sober when I was born, for God's sake. And he came over to me. He said the very same thing that first guy said to me when I was fresh out of treatment. Eddie goes, never seen you here before. What are you doing? This time I had a much better answer. I said, sir, it's very nice to see your meeting hall here, but I'm 2 years sober. I'm fresh out of the Navy. I'm going to school in the area. I'm going to be working. You won't see me very often, because I need to get a life. I'm going to be real busy. I'll stop by when I get a chance. And he just laughed the way he had this little laugh of, and he said, oh, son, school and work are just wonderful things for a young man like you. Wonderful. But that's what we do in between meetings. What he was really telling me is one of the secrets to long-term sobriety comfortably. And what he was really telling me by saying that was, son, you need to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world, instead of trying to live out there and hash it out there with those people and visiting us when convenient. And it's really been the cornerstone of how I've lived this last 29 years, is that I live with you guys. I am right here in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I've had the immense privilege of doing stuff all over the world as a result of that. I can kind of sum up a big part of what you guys have done for me with this little story. In 1998, I was asked to go to Nogales, Arizona to do exactly what I'm doing right now. And I called my mom. This is when everybody carried those nationwide pagers. Remember those pagers, right? Anybody in here still got one? Didn't think so. But there were big areas where the pager wouldn't work, right? There were the called blackout areas. And I figured, you know, Nogales, if there's going to be a blackout area, it's going to be Nogales. If you've ever been to Nogales, it's, you know, I'm not even sure they have cell phone coverage right now. So I called my mom before I left and I said, Mom, I'm going to be in Nogales this weekend, Nogales, Arizona. If you try to page me, I don't answer. I don't want you to worry. Right? I'm going to be in Nogales, Arizona. And she goes, oh, you need to call up Don and Leona. They retired down there. You need to give them a call. And I said, Mom, remind me, who's Don and Leona? She goes, oh, that's right. You probably haven't seen them since you were 9 years old. Don and Leona, Don was the best man at your father's and my wedding, lifelong friends. They would love to see you. And I, okay. So I called him up, called up Don. I go, Don, this is Carl Morris. I'm going to be in Nogales. I hear that's about 25 miles south of where you're at. Love to get together for lunch. He goes, oh, Carl, bring your golf clubs. I know you love to golf. And I'm like, well, that's true, but how does he know that? I mean, it's true. I'm like a golf whore. I'll golf with anybody at any time. In fact, I golfed on the way up here today. Right? But I was confused how he knew, but I brought my golf clubs, and on Saturday morning, I left the little conference I was at and drove up to where they were at, and I met him at his golf course. We started to walk along. And as we're walking along talking, he started to ask me very specific, pertinent questions about my life. He knew what school I had graduated from, what my degree was in, what companies I'd been with, the recovery homes I'm involved. He just knew everything about my life, and he could tell by the specific questions he's asking. I tried to throw in a couple of questions. What did you retire from? Where did you know? I hadn't seen him since I was 9. By the fourth hole, hang on, Don. I'm really confused. I haven't seen you since I was 9 years old. How do you know all this about my life? He goes, oh, that's easy. It's easy. First reason is, before your father passed away 2 years ago, you couldn't shut him up. He would go on and on and on about everything that's going on in your life. In fact, it was kind of irritating sometimes, Carl. But, you know, you should know. Your father was very proud of you. That wasn't news to me, because by taking your advice, I did not procrastinate in trying to reestablish my relationship with my father. The first thing you guys told me to do is, son, quit trying to be understood and learn how to understand, and you will be able to have a relationship with your father. Because I'd always, you don't understand me, right? And I'm the one that set up the barrier of understanding. He was always so kind and always so forgiving and loving. But he, you know, I'd set up a giant wall. As soon as I dropped that, we became really good friends. That was nice to know, but it wasn't news, right? But the next thing he said, I couldn't even swing the golf club after that. He said, besides, every Christmas I get that letter. I'm like, yes, finally I got into that letter. And I got 2 minutes. At the 17 years sober, I got married. We had two beautiful kids. The marriage did not work out, unfortunately. I know you've never heard of that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But you know what? We, after about 3 months of arguing, we fired our attorneys, and we looked at each other and said, you know what? We both love these kids, and we are not going to fight. We both love these kids with all our heart. We got to figure out how we're going to co-parent. Let's live very close. Let's get the kid back and forth, and let's quit arguing. You know what, we've done a pretty gosh darn good job at that, and she's a really good mother. She really is. She's a good mother, and I have all the respect in the world for her. But these two kids, I got to tell you, I didn't know I could love another human being this much. If you don't have kids, I swear to you, you'll find what I'm about ready to talk about somehow, but I found it through having kids. It's like I met who I would die for. I've never felt that before. I know when I joined the Navy and I raised my right hand, I said I would die for you, but I was really hoping it wasn't going to come to that. And I love other human beings. I love Lee. Lee and I travel together. We see each other a number of times per year. I love him. But you know what? If we're out at Starbucks later and some guy comes in wielding a gun saying, one of you is going to die, I was going to say, have you met my friend Lee? Right? I would. But if it's my kids, I would dive right in front of them without even a second thought. And I've never felt that way about another human being. It's a rich experience that I've never known. And I would never trade my kids for the first drink. Never in a million years. But I'm alcoholic. Although I would never trade them for the first drink, I would trade them for the second drink like that. So there is nothing that is more important than me staying in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because if I want to be a good dad, it starts here. Have a good night. Thanks.